Since this is a podcast, you can only hear me right now. But if you could see me, you'd be saying, whoa, who is that? It's me, Katie Helper. I'm just wearing the new fashion line from American Giant. Since 2011, they've been making high-quality, long-lasting, timeless American clothes, including their classic full zip, which was named the greatest hoodie ever made by Slate Magazine. Right now, I'm wearing the very stylish moto dress, perfect for feeling sporty and sleek, made with their soft and stretchy French terry fabric, and Aaron got the roughneck chore jacket, so he's looking good throughout his endlessly busy schedule. From activewear to work fits to the latest fashion picks, American Giant has it all. When most apparel companies have shipped too much overseas, making cheap disposable clothes and creating complicated global supply chains, American Giant stands for simple, local, high-quality goods. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use the code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code USEFUL. As you know far too well from listening to Useful Idiots, the 2024 election is coming fast. And while we can't predict for sure which candidate will win, we do know that either way, everyone else in the world will lose. Unless there was a fun and easy way to make a little extra cash on the whole terrible contest. That's right, betting's not just for sports fans anymore. Now it's the political junkies' time to shine. We figured that if we spend all our time on Twitter anyway, following the election and endless political analysis, why not put our knowledge to the test? It's MyBookie, a new sports book that lets you bet on the 2024 election from the general election down to who will win each state. If the world is crashing anyway, why not cash in? Don't miss out on this. Pick a side. Use promo code USEFUL to double your first deposit and instantly start with a leg up, only with MyBookie.
All right, welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Matt Taibbi.
And I'm Katie, fixing my hair, Helper.
How are you doing this week, Katie?
I'm okay. I think I'm doing okay. I mean, I'm trying to recover from some trauma. I was a bit triggered by a really important piece of writing, and we're going to get to that.
Adversarial journalism.
Yeah. Mittens of misogyny. Right. Misogynistic mittens. Mittens of white privilege. Subtle white privilege.
Right. But we have a lot to get to, including that wounding experience that you went through.
Yeah.
And we're going to touch upon some other themes. And we're going to talk to a very important person, a member of the United States Congress. And we're going to leave that a mystery for now.
A surprise, yeah.
A surprise. And let's just get into it, because we got a lot of stuff to get to, right? So
yeah. And no one will know the surprise except for every single person who sees the YouTube link.
Exactly.
And yeah, podcast title.
Yeah. It'll be a confounding mystery to you.
If you're illiterate, it will be.
Right. That's right. Yeah. So just keep listening. Okay. So for food groups, I guess we start with the Democrats suck, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm gonna stretch the genre here a little bit, because this is not really a Democrat per se. It's just somebody who's probably of that ilk politically. And so there was a remarkable editorial in the San
Francisco. Trigger warning, everyone. Sorry.
Yeah.
Trigger warning.
I did a compilation this year on the Wokest News Stories for 2020. I'm pretty sure this is going to be on the list for 2021. So the headline in this article in the San Francisco Chronicle was San Francisco high school students get a lesson in subtle white privilege.
Yeah.
And the byline is Ingrid Sayer-Oki.
Bernie's mittens, a lesson for SF high school students in subtle white privilege. And then it has a photo of him. Very weird choice, I would say, for those of you who are listening to the podcast and not watching. He's holding... What's he holding? He's holding something.
Manila folder,
probably of who's the most sexist writer? Probably some Jordan Peterson.
Right, yes.
I'm sure. He's holding manila folder, or maybe has a sign that's like, I hate all of you women and people of color here, but I have to be here. One of those two things. Anyway, he's holding manila folder, and he has one hand not in the mitten, and then he's holding the mittens and has one of them on, which is just extra white privilege.
And he's got a little bit of a Dr. Evil thing.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. And he's a little hunched. He turtles, as Joanne Reed's body expert like tells us he does.
1 million microaggressions.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Well, we should dive into the text, because the text is just, the interesting thing is, normally with an op-ed, you can pretty much guess where it's going from the headline. But when I saw the headline that basically it was about mittens, Bernie, and white privilege, I really struggled actually to guess what the punchline was going to be.
Well, Matt, that's because you have straight white male privilege and it blinded
right,
you.
Yes, of course, yes. So we'll put that out. Clearly, I'm inadequate to analyze this properly, but I'll just read it out and then you can take it from there. Sure. So there's two parts of this that are there's really only two passages that really even address the issue in there. But one of them is in a line that... that has one of the greatest uses of the word but that you'll see in an op-ed page. So here's the paragraph. I mean in no way to overstate the parallels. Senator Sanders is no white supremacist insurrectionist. But he manifests privilege, white privilege, male privilege, and class privilege in ways that my students could see and feel. So that's a quadruple whammy right there. He was clocking all the privileges at once mm-hmm. there.
Of course, she's a bit transphobic because she doesn't mention cis privilege, but we'll.
Oh, right. Yeah. Jesus.
We're going to have to break this down in privilege. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think we have to read some of the beginning just to get what she's talking about.
Okay. You want to read
the talk? Yeah. I just think that we'll have to do that to understand it. 3 weeks ago, I processed the Capitol insurrection with my high school students. Rallying our inquiry skills, we analyzed the images of that historic day. Images of white men storming through the Capitol fearless and with no forces to stop them. This, I said, is white supremacy. This is white privilege. It can be hard to pinpoint, but when we see it, we know it. Across our Zoom screen, they affirmed with nods, thumbs up, and emojis of anger and frustration. Fast forward 2 weeks as we analyzed images from the inauguration, asking again, what do we see? We saw diversity, creativity, and humanity, and a nation embracing all of this and more. On the day of the inauguration, Bernie Sanders was barely on our radar. The next day, he was everywhere. What do we see? I asked again. We've been studying diversity and discrimination in the United States. My students were ready. What did they see? They saw a white man in a puffy jacket and huge mittens, distant not only in his social distancing, but in his demeanor and attire. We took in the meaning of the day, the vulnerability of democracy, the power of ritual traditions, and the peaceful transition of power. We talked about gender and the possible meanings of the attire chosen by Vice President Kamala Harris, Dr. Jill Biden, the Biden grandchildren, Michelle Obama, Amanda Gorman, and others. We referenced the female warriors inspiring these women, like Madeleine Albright, the colors of their educational degrees and their monochromatic ensembles of pure power.
I didn't understand that passage at all. I don't know what she's
neither.
Talking about. Yeah,
and then she says
there should be a woke English woke dictionary on Google Translate.
Yeah, there should be. Yeah,
yeah.
And there across all of our news and social media feeds was Bernie memes, Bernie sweatshirts, endless love for Bernie. I puzzled and fumed as an individual as I strove to be my best possible teacher. What did I see? What did I think my students should see? A wealthy, incredibly well-educated and privileged white man showing up for perhaps the most important ritual of the decade in a puffy jacket and huge mittens. And then, as you said, Matt, I mean in no way to overstate the parallel. Senator Sanders is no white supremacist insurrectionist, but he manifests privilege, white privilege, male privilege, and class privilege in ways that my students could see and feel. When we see privilege, you know it, I told them weeks before, yet... when they saw Senator Bernie Sanders manifesting privilege when seemingly no one else did, I struggle to explain that disparity. I am beyond puzzled as to why so many are loving the images of Bernie and his gloves. Sweet, yes, the gloves knit by an educator. So Bernie. Not so sweet, the blindness I see of so many, Bernie included, to the privileges Bernie represents. I don't know many poor or working class or female or struggling to be taken seriously folk who would show up at the inauguration of our 46th president dressed like Bernie, unless those same folk had privilege, which they don't. Okay. There is so much to unpack here, and I want to invite her on. But where, I mean, this is, sorry, this is yours, although you should probably.
No, go for it. There's nothing I can do. Yeah, exactly.
One of my favorite things is she repeats her lines, puffy coat and what is
fumed,
it?
Fumed, I think she says a couple of times.
She says puzzled twice. That's what it is, puzzled.
She's going for like the spoken word effect.
Exactly. Right?
Which is like, you know, you could maybe do that if there was something poetic going on in the text.
God, Dan,
but this is like really, really shitty prose.
Can we set this to a drum beat? I agree. Can we set this to a drum beat later? Here's what she repeats. White man in a puffy jacket and huge mittens. And then she also repeats, when you see privilege, you know it.
Yeah, right. This is somebody who got upset because there were like Bernie memes on Twitter.
I know.
And thought that was stealing thunder from something. Whereas in fact, it's both people picking on Bernie, laughing at Bernie, laughing with Bernie. Yeah. It was a completely harmless, funny thing, you know?
I think that I'll say this and not you, and I'll get dragged for this, but there's some unresolved issues that these people have that they project onto Bernie.
Well, of course. I mean, first of all, to talk about how he has class privilege, this is a guy who came from, a family that was, slaughtered in the Holocaust. They grew up in the, very poor, very mean circumstances. And people always talk about his, what is he worth? $1.3 million.
Yeah.
And he has three houses. The guy is above 7 years old. He's been a U.S. senator. It's hard to make less money than that in that situation. And there, the Democratic Party is so full of people who have maximized completely all of their profit making opportunities by being in office. I mean, think about San Francisco. Just between Pelosi and Feinstein, what are they worth? $200 million?
Wow, Matt. I guess you're saying women shouldn't be paid. I guess you want Feinstein and Pelosi to govern from the home, barefoot and pregnant.
Okay, let's go on to Bill Clinton then, or, Bob Corker.
I mean, obviously,
I'm kidding, but
course, it's disgusting. And also, Bernie has money because he wrote a successful book.
He wrote a book.
Or two, yeah. And then I love when they say he has three homes, like as if not every single senator doesn't have two already, right? Everyone has two. They live in, they have a place in D.C. and then where they're from and representing. And the third house he has is like a country home or whatever that they got by, like, I think they did something with Jane's parents' inheritance. I mean, it's almost absurd that we're even talking about this, but I do just like to go through how ridiculous it is. But also, what does he spend his time doing? Does he spend his time trying to lower taxes for the group he's now in? No, he wants to raise taxes. He's actually advocating for the working class and those without privilege. And that is what kills me. Also, how much money does she make? How much money does he make as a senator? Do you know?
Just think about how much money people in government make. You know, people who have recently left government, they're making tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars a pop doing speeches to big companies. Like, he doesn't do that stuff. So he's sort of an example of how you can go through government and not make ass loads of money, even though you have the opportunity to do it anyway. But that's sort of beside the point. This article is sort of symbolic of some other thing that's that's going on in the national consciousness, which is just completely nuts. A lot of it is sort of specific to the Democratic Party, though, with their hangups about Bernie, which are so weird.
Why don't you? If I were writing this, I would be smart enough to say, yes, is it good that Bernie Sanders is fighting for policies that disproportionately help women, people of color, those without privilege?
Or even just say, like, I find Bernie Sanders incredibly annoying and don't people have something better to meet? Like, if that's what she's actually thinking, just say that, right?
Yeah, that wouldn't make a good op-ed.
Right, yes, exactly. Wouldn't make a good op-ed. Okay. One thing I did want to point out about this, so she's dragging Sanders for, I guess, dressing down, not dressing up enough.
Yeah.
If he had dressed in a Savile Row suit, we actually know what the headlines would be because we saw them with AOC. Like, we've seen this exact phenomenon where as soon as somebody who, identifies as a quote-unquote socialist in any way dresses up, then you get the battering headlines, right, where Dan, if we could see the tweet, there's one of them going after her for having a $14,000 outfit on Vanity Fair or whatever it is. The reality is Bernie wouldn't know how to dress up if you gave him like 6 weeks to prepare. You know what I mean? Like that, like it's just not in his DNA. He doesn't know how to.
I think we, right. So this is, someone tweeted, I wonder what brand of socialism allows you to get a $14,000 suit for Vogue photo shoots. See you soon, Alexandria. Looking forward to dismantling your socialist agenda in my finest Macy's clothes, like normal working people. Who's Lauren Boebert? She's running for Congress. So that's a right-wing critique, obviously. But yes, the Dems, the same libs who are going after him now would probably say, oh yeah, I guess you're not a socialist after all. And I gotta mention that green parka that he's had for years that people dragged him for, it's just so telling and interesting that was a gift from his son who works for the company that made them.
Right. Yeah. And also, I should just point out, I also think we're gonna be seeing a lot more of this kind of totally insane. Is the editorials that are going to make news by how nuts they are going to be going to fashion. So,
yeah, into fashion. So for Republican sucks, we're going to talk about how they really substantively suck with our guest. But top House Republican demands Psaki apologize over quote unquote disgraceful Space Force quip. And it shows Mike Rogers, who is the top Republican on the House Armed Services Committee. And, he has a pretty good hairpiece. I just want to give him a shout out for that.
Is that a hairpiece?
Right? Don't you think? Oh, come on. Dan, are you going to back me up on this or
it
what?
It does have a hairpiece.
It does have a hairpiece. I thought for sure.
Yeah, it's at a length that seems a little bit suspicious based on the overall non-receding hairline.
Yeah, and the lack of
clean it. Yeah, the clean lines and the hairs themselves look kind of a little too thick.
The absence of a sideburn is also a little.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it's all brown. I mean, I don't know how old he is, but anyway, viewers and listeners, please tweet at us using hashtag useful idiots pod and tell us if you think it's a wig.
That's a good one. You could probably in a pinch, you could drink coconut soup out of that, right? To turn it over.
That's a good test of it, right?
Yeah.
It would be a little messy because you'd have to balance it. But yeah, right. I think so. Yeah. Okay, so here's what happened. Ready? So Psaki was asked, so he wants her to immediately apologize for a response to a Space Force question. It's concerning to see the Biden administration's press secretary blatantly diminish an entire branch of our military as the punchline of a joke, which I'm sure China would find funny. And the Space Force was passed with near unanimous support in Congress, the same type of unity President Biden is supposedly working towards. Jen Psaki needs to immediately apologize to the men and women of the Space Force for this disgraceful comment. And this is because she was asked about the future of the Space Force during a press conference. And she said, wow, Space Force, it's the plane of today. It's an interesting question. I'm happy to check with our Space Force point of contact. I'm not sure who that is. I will find out and see if we have an update on that.
So, I'll circle back with you.
Circle back, yeah. And so that wasn't the only Republican with the courage to take on that disrespectful response. Rep. Michael Waltz from, of course, Florida, said this is just another example of the Biden administration not taking China seriously while demeaning the incredible work of Space Force personnel. To be fair, though, he is a founding member of the House Space Force Caucus, so he's obviously biased. I mean, I do like the fact that they really see this as a threat from China.
Everybody's lying awake worrying about something that's going to happen to them. You know, it's for some people, it's just big, huge mittens. And for other people, it's Chinese and in space, I guess.
Oh, my God. Chinese in space. That sounds like a history of the world. Remember
Mel Brooks?
Mel Brooks. He had Jews in space, actually, which is very good.
Jews in space. That's right.
And then Hitler on ice.
Hitler on ice.
An Amish funeral. These were all and you see the Amish funeral. Viking funeral. I'm sorry.
Viking funeral.
That was my
very
Jewish
different.
Privilege, glumping all non-Jews together. Yeah. They take off their helmets and they have the horns on their heads.
Right.
The
yes.
Vikings. Yeah.
Jen Psaki's. I don't think she's gonna make it.
Like, yeah.
She's gonna become a meme in like 10 seconds. And
well, people seem to love her though. They do the Psaki bombs hashtag, and you know. I really highly recommend her being asked about GameStop and pointing out that Janet Yellen is the first female treasurer.
That was amazing. fantastic.
That's amazing. Great woke wash. Yeah.
It was like inspired irrelevancy, which is what you want in your press secretary.
Yeah.
In order to be a really good press secretary with lasting qualities, you have to have no human, observable human qualities. And your face has to be like a mask of death. You know?
To be fair, Ari Fleischer was very good at that.
Very good at that. Yes.
Yeah. And also most of Trump's. They all look like sociopaths.
Right. So we sort of switch places, right? So I get, isn't that weird this week? So in the spirit of a previous story that we did on the same theme, Dan, if we could see the clip that I posted for Isn't That Weird? With CNN's John Berman, who is now continuing what looks like it's going to be a storied tradition.
So I don't think we should be sort of chippy about meeting with Republicans first, to tell you the truth.
So you are going to sit and listen to the Senate impeachment trial of the former president of the United States, who has been impeached for inciting the erection, inciting the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol.
Does she laugh at that?
Let's watch the face, because she's pretty. Yeah. It's impressive, actually.
Well, I was, when I did this and I rewatched it, I was sort of accounting for the tape delay, but you can see the heavy blink when it's the audio of his slip
delivered.
It's delivered.
When it arrives. Yeah. This is like the Fartgate analysis.
Let's check it out. Are going to sit and listen to the Senate impeachment trial of the former president of the United States, who has been impeached for inciting the erection, inciting the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol.
So this again obviously follows up the Chuck Schumer's inciting the erection. So one thing that will happen with something like this is that it starts to like fly around the ether a little bit, and now anytime anyone says inciting the insurrection, that word erection is going to be in there because of these news stories. We got to get the word out as much as possible.
Yeah.
That this is a mistake that you could make if you're going to try to say the word insurrection.
Exactly. Yeah. You mean erection? I mean, sorry, insurrection.
Right. Don't think about it. Don't worry that you're going to say erection instead of insurrection.
Right.
Just try to avoid worrying about that. Right. And you'll be fine.
Also, let's put it the other way around too. Make sure you don't say, you know, you're taking medicine for insurrection dysfunction. Insurrectionile.
If you have an insurrection that lasts longer than 4 hours,
contact.
Please kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So should we go to Isn't That Terrible?
We should. And just make sure not to say erection.
Okay, I won't. Yeah. So we have an impeding story here. If we could just click on the link, Dan, and which takes us to UpRocks and takes us to a viral story, apparently. And the headline is, well, here's the trailer for a movie starring Steve Mnuchin's wife as a sex addicted hedge fund manager.
This is the greatest thing ever.
Just reading from this, because we'll be feeling the surreal effects of Donald Trump's presidency for years to come, Louise Linton, the wife of Trump's former Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, just dropped a trailer for Me, You, Madness, a modern romantic comedy. Here's the official synopsis, and then we're going to luckily watch the trailer. Me, You, Madness tells this deliciously wicked tale about a beautiful, ruthlessly ambitious, intelligent, and successful businesswoman, Catherine Black, plays by Louise Linton. She lives a life of luxury, having an architectural dream house in Malibu, exclusive designer fashions, fast cars, and exquisite jewelry. She has no need for a man except to satisfy her natural serial killer instinct, literally. When Tyler, Ed Westwick, a petty thief, responds to her online roommate ad, he thinks he's struck gold. He has no idea that after a night of partying and passion, he is really just on her menu to be her next victim until real romance gets in the way. So could we play the trailer, Dan?
And by the way, this was sent to me by way of an old pal from Russia, who is the lead singer of a band called Detsky Panadol. So I just wanted to say.
Oh, really? You're getting your talking points and news from Russia, Matt? Wow.
Yes, I am. Yes,
this is from
the Russians. Yeah, he's actually not Russian. He's from Philly.
Okay.
My name is Catherine Black. You may think that I'm a materialistic, narcissistic, self-absorbed misanthrope.
I don't deny it.
I'm a hedge fund manager. I'm addicted to fashion, the accumulation of money, exercise, and sex. My life is incredible.
Hi. I have an appointment about renting the room. Nice gigs.
You got a plastic Mustang?
Your list?
Every single day. Now I gotta
cut loose. Wow. Oh, that's acting.
I had a soft spot for him. Who knew? I hadn't felt a soft spot for anything since I was six. They're very sexy.
Don't get carried away. Keep your focus on the task at hand.
How did I not see it coming? You thieving little twit. I think I'm going to disembowel this kid and kill him.
I think I really like this girl.
The dialogue was like
so good.
It's like from a porn movie. Yeah. Basically, but worse. I'm here about the room.
And you know, obviously, that Mnuchin founded, he's the CEO of Dune Entertainment. And so she had to take over when he became Secretary of Treasury.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this tells us a lot about a lot. It's almost like somebody watched American Psycho and just didn't get any of the jokes and
right.
decided to make their own version, except minus the point. I don't know.
Do you know it's really funny? Yeah, it is. It's a real, it's almost admirable.
Yeah. So that was the person who was at the side of our Treasury Secretary during the Trump years. Very funny stuff. I hope that movie becomes a big hit.
Yeah, we should do a double feature where we watch that and then the Colonel Sanders with Mario Lopez.
Oh yes, that's a good one. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Maybe we should take a bunch of edibles and do that.
Yeah. If you're a business owner, you don't need us to tell you that running a business is tough. But you might be making it harder on yourself than necessary. Don't let QuickBooks and spreadsheets slow you down anymore. It's time to upgrade to NetSuite. Stop paying for multiple systems that don't give you the information you need when you need it. Ditch the spreadsheets and all the old software you've outgrown. Now is the time to upgrade to NetSuite by Oracle, the world's number one cloud business system. NetSuite gives you visibility and control over your financials, HR, inventory, e-commerce, and more. Everything you need all in one place instantaneously. Whether you're doing a million or hundreds of millions in revenue, save time and money with NetSuite. Join the over 24,000 companies using NetSuite right now. Let NetSuite show you how they'll benefit your business with a free product tour at netsuite.com/useful. Schedule your free product tour right now at netsuite.com/useful. netsuite.com/useful.
All right, so we have a couple of things we wanted to just quickly go over before we talk to our mystery guest. But obviously, in the wake of GameStop, the whole brouhaha on Wall Street, and which is ongoing, by the way, and continues to be a crazy story. We heard from some of the country's leading commentators, including old friend Tom Friedman,
friend of show
Tom Friedman, who was interviewed by Andrew Ross Sorkin, another friend of show, and they had this exchange, which I think is if anybody who knows Thomas Friedman knows that the man is famous for his metaphors. He has like a unique ability to make images that don't agree with one another or don't make sense.
Right.
Like one of them being, you know, his rule of holes. You know, when you're in three holes, stop digging. You can't be in three holes. But here is Tom Friedman's metaphorical analysis of GameStop, which I thought we should spend just a few minutes on.
Welcome back to Squawk Box this morning. The Reddit rebellion of high-flying stocks putting a squeeze on traditional capitalism. And joining us right now for a look at the challenges ahead, New York Times foreign affairs columnist Tom Friedman. His latest column, Made in the USA, Socialism for the Rich, Capitalism for the Rest. And your column speaks to what we've seen happen in the markets this week and what this Reddit army, in fact, believes and what they're fighting against.
Well, you know, Andrew, I see the whole thing is like I'm watching a giant National Geographic nature film. This is how I would actually explain it to a young person who's trying to understand what happened. I mean, like a 5-year-old. First, there were these people called lions. They're long sellers.
These people called
and
lions.
They noticed a wildebeest that seemed to be hobbling. It was called GME stock, and they ate it. The stock was $163, went down to $4. Then along came the hyenas. They're called short sellers. And they fed off the carcass of GME. And these hyenas, they're magical hyenas, they actually made the carcass grow 50% larger than it really was.
That's so accessible.
Right? It simplifies it.
A whole new group. Yeah. Okay. And they were vultures who ate the hyenas, basically. And the really smart vultures ate and flew away when the stock was $500. The dumb ones are going to stick around and keep eating. And in the end, the lions will come along and eat them, and the stock will eventually go back to $4 or $5. It's the circle of life. Hakuna Matata.
Hakuna Matata, baby.
You think he, how many times do you think he wrote that? Like, how many times did he look that over, do you think?
So there's like 19 things wrong, like, that are crazy about this, but we'll just go over a few.
If you were stoned, doesn't this make a lot of sense? This
it does. Could be it our makes a lot of moment. Sense if you're,
we should
if
totally
you're stoned.
Read it later. Stone. I mean, as if we're stoned, yeah.
I mean, if you're high, you just simplified the matter incredibly.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Yeah, he starts out, there were these people called lions, you know, okay.
Auspicious start, always.
Yeah, like, maybe just say there were these lions. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, don't confuse people with that. And then he says that the lions are the long sellers, and they eat the stock, they eat the wildebeest, and the wildebeest decline in value. But first of all, why are wildebeest declining in value? Like, if you're going to make the wildebeest into a stock, don't make them wildebeest. Just talk about stock. You know what I mean? Like,
but he's trying to explain it.
Right, but he should be able to explain it without having to put it in numerical terms. Anyway.
I see what you're saying. Right,
you see what I'm saying? Like, you say, oh, they ate the wildebeest and the wildebeest are gone, or whatever it was, right? You know what I'm saying? They went from 63 to 4. Like, wildebeest don't go.
They don't play the stock market.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So then he goes down, and the long sellers who have now magically made the stock go from 63 to 4, which I think he means that there were people who bet the stock up to 63 and then it went down. These people called lions, but whatever. Then they're eaten by these magical hyenas who, how do you eat something and make it increase 50% in size?
Oh, well, actually, that's like with popcorn. If you eat popcorn and drink soda, it expands.
I see.
So he needs to add that. So what is this? What is it? A magical hyena?
Hyenas are eating the wildebeest carcass. They should just drink some 7-Up.
Yeah, exactly. They're actually, they're eating the wildebeest carcass that has been turned into popcorn.
He talks about how the vultures come in and they eat the hyenas. Like, he kind of left out, like, how did the hyenas die? Or, like, were they, you know, vultures obviously usually carry on. Right, so were these dead hyenas? Were these alive hyenas? I don't know.
Well, they are magic.
It's a very minor thing.
Magic, so yeah.
The hyenas were magic.
Right, so they could be dead. They could be alive. They could be, you know, in this sweet spot of not mortal and mortal.
Right. Okay. So then again, he has the vultures, the smart vultures, and remember, he's trying to simplify.
Yeah.
The story by making it about animals, but then he's talking about animals who are buying at 500. So he's just talking about stocks again. So the smart vultures eat the hyenas, which are actually stock that are worth 500.
Right.
And then they fly away, and the ones that are remaining are eaten by the lions, who, remember, are supposed to be the long sellers. Except that they're eating at 500, and they're gonna I guess digest it for. I think what he actually means is short, but it's just complicated.
How old are your kids, Matt?
7, 5, and 3.
Okay, so what I think we should do by next week is you should show them this and see
if they get it.
Well, of course they'll get it. The only question is which age drops off. Because I'm predicting the 7-year-old, what is it, 7, 5, and 3. I think the 7 and 5-year-olds are going to get it. The 3 maybe won't. And if they don't get it, you're going to have to get them tested.
Right, right, yeah. Well, because it's all so clear.
Yeah. That would be great. Everyone film your kids responding to this. I want a split screen or send it to us. We'll do a split screen.
I feel bad for Tom because he, you know, obviously made fun of him a lot over the years, and I kind of swore that I wouldn't.
But then he went ahead and did something like this.
Then he did this. It's just too funny. Like, I'm sure I'm missing a whole lot. And if there are people out there in the show who want to point out some other things about how not to do a metaphor or an analogy, but this one was amazing. You know, because remember, they're trying to make this simpler.
I mean, how could I not remember? It was very simple for me. I found it very accessible.
Very, very, very strange. Yeah. So that was a classic, I thought. I think we had to at least touch on that.
If you were doing your famous vampires, what was your Goldman Sachs
A great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity. Yeah.
Okay. So how would you have done that Thomas Friedman style?
Oh, my God. Yeah, that would be tough. I don't know. I'll have to think about that because vampire squid's a pretty obscure animal to begin with. First of all, you'd have to use... The thing is, I actually did do a little bit of a Friedmanism in that because vampire squids don't have blood funnels. I used a mention a blood funnel in it later on.
Oh, that's okay.
And that actually was the part of a reason that it almost didn't make it into print because the fact checkers didn't want to let it through. So I was trying to say that that's part of the joke is that it's nonsensical, the image. But
I see.
But if you were doing it Friedman style, you'd have to do it something like a great vampire squid hoofing it up to, you know, the surface or something like that.
Stealing.
Relentlessly jamming its blood funnel. Yeah. And you know, digging its talons into the carcass of America or something like that.
Yeah, but you'd have to put in a financial transaction.
Right. Yeah, he would be eating a fish, which is actually a bunch of dollars that would decline in value.
Now you get it. Now you get it, Matt. Now you're making it simple. Now you're making it make
The great
sense.
Vampire squid dug its talons into a fish, which is actually a sum of money.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So can you rewrite that for next week?
I will. I'll do that. I'll take it on as an assignment. Yeah. But it's good stuff. Anything else we want to get to quick
You want to do a quick review of Mandalorian?
Sure.
Can you just explain this segment for people who may not, who may be joining us recently and don't know about this segment?
Yeah, we've decided to kind of get in on the whole reviewing of popular television shows, except, you know, the twist with us is that we're not actually going to know what we're talking about because we didn't watch them.
Right.
So these are reviews of shows we have not watched yet.
Right. So The Mandalorian, of course, is an American space Western television series created by Jon Favreau for the streaming service Disney. And it is the first live action series in the Star Wars franchise. And just so you know, the cast includes Pedro Pascal, Rosario Dawson, Mark Hamill. So I liked it because I like Rosario Dawson, even though she's dating Cory Booker. I thought that the Mandalorian character was adorable. I didn't like, though, that it was, I think ultimately an infantilized Yoda, like literally infantilized him. And I didn't like the love interest. He can't have a love interest at that age. So I didn't like that he was dating Rosario Dawson's character.
He's dating Rosario Dawson?
Yeah, in the show. I'm pretty sure. Okay. I mean, she's in it. Why she should be a love interest. I'm assuming she is. So,
for
Baby Yoda, yeah.
I think that's not suitable for children, certainly.
Exactly. So here's what I would say about Mandalorian. It's a great art house film, kind of like Harold and Maude. Remember that movie?
Right.
So great, which is about a much older woman, a younger man. But that's not okay for kids.
Yeah, that's not what we should be showing is Rosario Dawson having sex with Baby Yoda. I mean, you and I might find that interesting.
Yeah, but it's not appropriate for kids. Yeah. So, I mean, I think we should probably start a letter writing campaign based on this.
Right. Yes,
having not seen it, we're offended. And anyone who tries, we're traumatized, we're triggered. Anyone who tries to correct us will say are normalizing abuse.
That's right. Plus, the scenes were so graphic, too.
They were so graphic.
It was so unnecessary.
It was so unnecessary, yeah.
They could have just implied a lot of it. I mean, the scene just went on for way too long, just over and over and over and over again. Like, we get it. You know, once you show that image once, you don't have to show it over and over again. We don't like the show right?
Well, no, Matt, that's not fair. I think what makes the show and why it's so important to talk about it is that we do like it. It's very compelling. And what really is problematic is that I actually think that they present those sex scenes between Rosario Dawson and Yoda as love scenes. And right. I think it's really dangerous because it kind of distracts from the... This is... it's age inappropriate. I mean, guys, the guy is called Baby Yoda. What else do you need to know? How can you film those sex scenes with a Baby Yoda? How? What about
everybody
children?
Who is involved is complicit. All right.
Today's guest is none other than Representative Ro Khanna, who represents California's 17th district. He was also one of the chairs of the Bernie Sanders for President campaign. And he's just a great guy, return offender, return guest. And what I really like about Ro, is his foreign policy stuff. What do you really like about Ro, Matt?
That and his domestic policy as well. His frankness.
Yes. And good on civil liberties.
Oh, that too. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And as it's not a coincidence that we're going to talk to him about some of those issues right now. So let's get to that conversation.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us again. We always love talking to you. Could you just start off by telling us what is happening right now in Congress and where everything stands in terms of the COVID relief or lack thereof?
Sure, Katie. We just had a call this morning with the caucus, with President Biden, talking about putting the COVID relief bill through the House and the Senate. This week, today, actually, we're going to vote on reconciliation to give the House and the Senate the authority to do the package through reconciliation. My view is we have to stand firm on the $1.9 trillion and get that passed through the House or the Senate. If Republicans want to vote for it, great. If they don't, this is what we need for the country, and we should do it.
And can you just explain how that could work, how the Democrats could get that through without Republican support?
Well, they could get it through with the reconciliation process. I expect that there will be 50 senators who will vote for reconciliation. Senator Manchin has said he will vote for reconciliation. I expect it'll pass the House today. And so under reconciliation, you can pass anything on 50 votes and even a minimum wage. You know, I personally think minimum wage should come under reconciliation, which is anything to do with spending or taxes. You can argue that a $15 minimum wage would increase people's wages, so increase the tax revenue that the government can collect. But even if you don't buy that argument, you could certainly get there by saying there should be a tax penalty on any employer who doesn't pay $15. So there are multiple ways to structure this bill that will pass muster with reconciliation. And that's what we ought to be working on.
I've seen some news stories suggesting that in the final version, there might be some sort of a limit on who can receive this. Like they might grade out at $75,000 or $100,000 for a couple. Like where does that stand right now? Is will there be any form of,
means testing?
Well, it's already means tested. I mean, it doesn't go to people who make over 250 or 300,000. I don't think that we ought to further restrict the incomes. I mean, where some people have floated this idea that people making over 50,000 shouldn't get it, or couples making over 100,000. Many of those are working class, middle class. Their spending has taken a hit. They've had hardship where they've had to juggle looking after kids and working. And so I've had reduction in hours. So this should be a broad based package that helps working class and middle class families across the country. That's what we campaigned on, what we promised, and what we need to deliver.
Congressman, a couple of weeks ago, you signed a letter that I thought was really, really interesting, that was basically warning against starting off a new war on terror or domestic war on terror. Could you talk a little bit about your thought process in signing that letter and what you were, A, concerned about and what you're still seeing going forward that might be concerning?
Sure. Well, Rashida Tlaib led that letter and has really advocated for civil liberties. My career started in politics. I got killed in my first campaign, but I ran for two reasons. The war in Iraq, I was opposed to it, and the Patriot Act. I saw firsthand back in 2004 how that act was used to actually racially profile back then, many brown Americans, brown male Americans, I mean, the amount of times I had to go through advanced screening in airport securities is innumerable. But I had people who I knew who were American citizens who were told to go back to the country they belonged to. And I saw the expansive powers of the state that the Patriot Act had granted. It was an overreaction to a very calamitous, tragic, serious event of 9/11. So no one is diminishing the awful attack of 9/11. But what we're saying is we have to have a response that's consistent with our constitutional values. Otherwise, we are giving in to the very goals of terrorism, was to disrupt liberal democracy. The same thing with the Capitol riots, the mob that attacked the Capitol, very, very problematic. We ought to use all the law enforcement tools to get after the perpetrators, but we shouldn't be expanding the surveillance state. We shouldn't be expanding the powers of government to suppress dissent and speech in a way that could be abused.
Right. It could, I mean, it's all these things could be enforced, right? To go after the people who participated without creating new laws.
Exactly. Because what you don't want to do is have new laws that then aren't just going after insurrectionist or mobs, but are actually having a chilling effect on protest movements against police violence or protest movements for climate change, or used in the wrong hands for suppressing dissent, for suppressing counter speech, or used to profile. So my concern is that I think it's important for progressives to be consistent, and we have to protect the civil liberties of all Americans, regardless of their race or the cause that they're advocating, but enforce the laws that actually go after violence. And there's a lot of those laws on the books that are sufficient to hold those who engaged in the mob insurrection accountable.
Can you talk about your experience on January 6th?
Sure. I was fortunate. I was in the Cannon building, which is my office where I'm currently am. And we had to evacuate because there was this bomb threat. We now know that that bomb threat was a purposeful distraction so that the police would focus on that and leave the Capitol. I evacuated and I started actually, I went to the cafeteria in Longworth, and then I was going to go to the Capitol, and I had people on my team, Jules, our press person, and Emma and Pete, actually texting me frantically saying, don't go into the Capitol. It's been overrun. Go back to your office. And I was in communication with them, and it was unclear whether they had cleared the Cannon building or there was still a threat. We thought it was clear. And in any case, it was much better than going anywhere else. And so I went into my office, locked the door, and then stayed there till late at night. So I didn't fear for my safety when I was in the office, but certainly the members of Congress who were in the Capitol, what a harrowing experience.
Were you in touch with them? Were you texting them or?
Some of them. I mean, some of them I was texting, but some of them we were so cautious. We didn't know, you know, I didn't want to disturb someone or who knows where they were. I did have some people texting me, more staff who said, can I come to your office? And I said, absolutely. And unfortunately, no one was hurt who texted me, but they didn't make it to my office because they were concerned of being in the hallways and the risk. But it was definitely a traumatic experience in this country that we'll remember for the rest of our lives.
Did you interact with any of the rioters at any point during that day?
I did not. I saw them from my window, and then they told us to move away from the windows. But I did not, fortunately, did not interact with them.
The letter that you sent, I'm sorry to go back to this, it's just that's really interesting to me. The one of the things that I think a lot of people are saying is, oh, well, we need expanded power and we need to go specifically to go after these sort of conservative right wing people. But one of the things that your points that your letter raises is that these powers always end up being used in all directions. And it cites as an example the FBI's assessment authority being used against Black Lives Matter. I thought that was an interesting example. Could you talk a little bit about that and what that is, and so people understand how these powers can be expanded?
Sure. I mean, in the history in this country is that the tools of law enforcement have often been used against Black and brown people more than they have been used to enforce against right-wing terrorist groups, and so right-wing extremist groups. And so my concern, and those who signed that letter, is that you don't want to give broad powers to the FBI to engage in assessments and searches, internet searches, and more broadly searches of individuals without court-ordered warrants and without court-ordered authority, because that power could be abused. And by the way, it shouldn't be abused even when you're dealing with extreme right-wing groups. I mean, that there's a reason we have a nation of laws and we have civil liberties. And I'm confident that within our framework, we should be able to solve this. I mean, first of all, we do need reform on social media, but the reality is, it's not like these people were hidden. I mean, they probably need to hire some folks in, you know, high school or college to go understand social media. And half of the folks confessed on Parler or Facebook. So why don't you beef up sort of social media observation, which is in the public square, figure out what you can do without invading people's civil liberties.
Can you talk more about that, about how to balance kind of safety with content moderation and, of course, like big tech?
Yes. Well, first of all, big tech and these social media companies, I think, are absolutely to blame for what happened. And the reason they're to blame is that it's not just that they provide a platform for speech. They have actively recommended certain types of speech based on construction of social media profiles. So if someone has a certain profile, they're feeding them information about QAnon. They're feeding them information about some of these groups, and they're recommending that content. That is, in my view, a fundamental violation of individual human autonomy, of our ability to have independent thinking when you have go online and you're fearful that you're being manipulated. And so the first thing we need to do is, and this was the Internet Bill of Rights that Tim Berners-Lee, who founded the World Wide Web, and I had introduced or worked on 2 years ago, is to have opt-in consent for any use of data and the ability to determine what type of algorithms are going to use that data. And until we have that, I think the social media platform, the digital platform, is a platform of which is subject to manipulation. The second thing is, believe it or not, the law currently, if you engage in speech that incites violence, that is unlawful under Brandenburg, social media doesn't need to take it down, even if there's a court order that says that speech is illegal. We need to reform Section 230 to say if there's illegal speech found by a court order, that speech doesn't belong on social media.
Right. And there's a difference between permitting speech and promoting it, right? Which is the issue with
Facebook. That's a
good
Facebook.
Line. Yeah. I stole it from Zephyr Teachout. It's on my show. Yeah. But it is a good line. Yeah.
She's brilliant. I mean, you're very, very insightful yourself, Gabe, but that's a good line. It's exactly right. I mean, Facebook is actively promoting speech, and it's not just promoting speech. It's promoting speech based on a manipulation of individual data. And you look at one of the big concerns of modern democracy, and it's that people are suspicious, right? There's a suspicion of the truth, which led to this epistemic crisis where 30, 40% of the country doesn't even believe the election results. And partly it's, well, everyone is corrupt and they're all in it for their own self-interest. And so we're going to deny the possibility of any consensus on truth. Well, social media is amplifying that in a huge way by making us so suspicious that we can't even have a conversation. But what is the platform doing to manipulate us in subtle ways? And so it's further eroding trust in the public sphere. And this is deeply problematic for a democracy. So Shana Zuboff had a brilliant piece. I don't agree with all of the conclusions, but a brilliant piece in the New York Times and her book on surveillance capitalism that goes into why this is such a problem.
But the idea of giving consumers an opt-out, also the advantage of that is also that it's not like a top-down solution. It's like empowering the consumer rather than forcing some kind of a template on the experience as well, right?
Exactly, man. And I don't think we should give Zuckerberg and Dorsey the power to decide what is truth and the power to be an arbiter. The other interesting paper that I'd seen, it's two professors, not my idea, but they did this study and they found that when you crowdsource news sources, it turns out Republicans and Democrats actually have a fair amount of consensus on what they consider credible sources. And so there are tools like crowdsourcing, like opt-in consent. They're not perfect, but they can give people more agency and control over their online experience.
You called for an investigation into Robinhood's decision recently to restrict trading into stocks like GameStop and some others. Could you talk a little bit about what your concerns were there, and you also mentioned the need for a financial transactions tax. How would that apply in this story?
Well, what happened is actually, in my view, pretty simple. I mean, the Robinhood CEO is out there obfuscating the facts, but basically, the stock got hot and they didn't have the money to cover the collateral that they needed for buyers to continue to trade on it. Well, why didn't they disclose to all their investors that if a stock gets hot, their capital is going to run out and they can only cover trades up to X amount? They never had that disclosure. There's been no capital requirements on them. And so the CEO is out there saying it wasn't a liquidity event, but he's parsing words because it would have been a liquidity event if they had actually continued with trading. So what we need to do is first have much more disclosure, better disclosure laws on platforms like Robinhood, where they're being honest with investors. And so they have the capital reserves, so you don't have this asymmetry where the hedge funds can trade because they're more capitalized, but retail investors can't because online trading platforms don't have the capital reserves. The financial transaction tax, which just shows, I mean, we had so much speculative bubble with the hedge funds, and that not just in this case, but in general, that if you had a small financial transaction tax and you put that money towards building things and education and healthcare, it's a more productive use, in my view, of our dollars than just having the over-financialization of the economy, where you have all of this money with hedge funds going into betting that isn't necessarily increasing our productivity, which is not just my opinion, it's a fact. I mean, productivity in this country has not increased nearly the rate it should have. And part of that, I think, is the over-financialization of the economy.
How do you interpret what GameStop was all about? I mean, I've talked to some of the investors who were involved, and a lot of people talk about frustrations with, you know, the idea of the modern financialized American economy and the after the bailouts of 2008 and again last year. They feel like it's already all gambling, is a phrase you hear all the time, that the market is already detached from reality, and they feel like it's just their turn this time. Like they're going to do the same thing to these hedge funds that the hedge funds have been doing to the rest of the country. Do you see it as a political statement, or is it something else? Is it just people being opportunistic, take advantage of a situation?
Well, Matt, like anything else, it's probably complex. There are probably some people who are really wanting to stick it to the hedge fund and make a political statement. There are probably some hedge funds on the other side who are Redditors and who are getting in on the action. And then there's some people I know. One person I know put in $50,000 and was worth $1 million. And, you know, he's not someone who makes a lot of money. And so there are some people, ordinary people, who have the opportunity to say, this is our chance to make money. What I would say we should take away from all of this is let's make the rules as fair as possible so retail investors aren't at a disadvantage to institutional investors. But second, let's take a step back and remember that 50% of Americans aren't in the stock market. It was interesting to me, all of the advocacy I did for retail investors and Reddit, that on Twitter, it actually did really, really had resonance, and people were retweeting it and talking about it, and the media was talking about it. It didn't actually on Facebook, where one of the differences of Facebook audience tends to be older and actually many, many more voters. And it just is a reminder that a lot of the country is not in the stock market, and they certainly don't trade every day. And what are we doing in terms of their lives, their economics? So, yes, we need fairer rules, but let's not think that this is some magical solution for wage stagnation or the lack of good jobs.
Well, I mean, Matt, I'm kind of surprised that you asked the congressman about that, because we just talked about Thomas Friedman's excellent analogy. I'm not sure if you've heard about this, Representative Khanna, but he compared them to lions, vultures, and hyenas, and then ended his rant with Hakuna Matata, the circle of life, baby.
For the Lion King.
yeah. Well,
right, yeah. I will have to read it. And certainly the vulture capitalism, I mean, with the hedge funds, where you have people short a stock, then come on podcasts or shows like yours and say, oh, this stock is doing terribly, sell. I mean, it's maybe not technically manipulation, but it strikes me as pretty manipulative. And that's what's been going on for years.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of that. I mean, it's almost a standard part of the programming on a lot of financial TV. You have somebody on a hedge fund who comes on and says, oh, the bottom's about to fall out of this market. And then, you know, they're probably short something or other. It goes down and then they say, oh, it's time for the recovery. So they're calling the top and the bottom of the market. And, you know, to ordinary retail investors, that looks like pure manipulation, doesn't it? You know,
I completely agree, man. And disclosure and transparency doesn't solve everything, but in this case, I think it would solve a lot. I mean, one thing should be that if you are actually invested in a stock, you should be forced to disclose it. So if you go on TV or if you're on the internet and you're advocating buying or selling or making a comment, it should be a disclaimer that you're invested and have a financial stake in that stock.
Right.
So I want to ask you about appearing on the criticism you've gotten for appearing on Fox News and for, I mean, you wrote an op-ed for the Daily Caller, and both of these are chances for you to basically, like on Fox News, you talked about the Pentagon's bloated budget. And for the Daily Caller, it was about, you know, welcoming back the troops, not delaying their return. And I was wondering if you have, are given the opportunity or the invitation by places like MSNBC or the New York Times, for instance, to talk about or write about these issues about war.
Well, Gary, I mean, I have had the chance to talk about them in on MSNBC. The New York Times is just hard to talk about anything. It's hard to get any op-ed published. But I think the broader point is this. So do I think in a perfect democracy, in a good democracy, that we would have a public sphere where everyone had equality and listened to each other's opinions and racism and sexism didn't have any place, and that would be an ideal democracy? Absolutely. We don't have that. So then the question is, okay, we don't have a perfect public sphere for deliberation and discussion. Do we just not go on forums that reach millions of Americans? Or do we recognize that these are imperfect forums, but that we have to participate to try to build as big a coalition? And people of goodwill can disagree. You know, a person I respect, Mehdi Hasan, he says, well, no, you need to boycott any forums that have explicit misogyny and racism. My view of it is that as long as I'm not compromising my values, I should go on reasonably as many of these forums to try to reach as many people as possible.
Yeah, and I also think that if you care about misogyny and racism, you want to reach people to make the case for various things, like critiquing and drawing attention to the Pentagon's bloated budget, for instance, is a step in the direction of actually stopping or curtailing or preventing more wars. And wars are fought against people in countries often who are Black and brown, against those civilian populations. And so I find that the anti-racist argument against appearing on networks to be honestly kind of a thin one.
So okay, I obviously agree with you that, you know, there's a great Canadian philosopher, Charles Taylor, who's written about multicultural democracy. One of the points that I've learned from his work is that people who have racial prejudice or sexist views, that has to be confronted. But they also have other views on other things. And sometimes trying to get a agreement on those other views doesn't mean that you condone the racism or the sexism, but it may help break down some of that racism and sexism than if you were to just completely shun them or ignore them. These are difficult questions, but the point I think is, as we try to build this multiracial, multicultural democracy, how do we get to 40-45%? Because if we just write them that segment completely off, I don't think we're going to get to the goals that many of your listeners want.
Yeah. I mean, how does boycotting them, what does that do? It doesn't like achieve anything except further polarization, and you're preventing people from hearing important messages. I just don't, it seems that's so like putting your head in the sand to me, boycotting.
Or to put another way, you know, what you were talking about in the way that the tech companies are responsible for keeping people in bubbles by, constantly reaffirming their opinions by giving them content we know that they're going to agree with, or that they know that they're going to agree with. doesn't going on those channels help break up that pattern in a way, right? Like if you're helping to diversify the landscape a little bit every time you appear on one of those networks, because otherwise if you boycott them, then everybody's by nature separate.
I think so, and it helps you understand what the opposition to your arguments are and how you can frame things, and maybe even helps you think of something from a different angle. I mean, I think that this idea that we have a monopoly on truth, a certitude about truth, I think is part of the challenge in a democracy. I mean, you have to have your convictions, and I'm not saying compromise your convictions, but there has to be an understanding that you're in a democracy where you have to respect participation, opinion, criticism. And to me, that's the basic thing. Now, obviously, there's probably an absurd level where you wouldn't go on every single show. And I'm sure there's a line there. But my instinct and inclination is to be broader in inclusivity than to shut forums
out. Yeah. And what do you want to call out Joe Biden? Call in. Let's give you the opportunity to call in Joe Biden. What is the most disappointing thing that he's done or not done? And what is the thing that you want to urge him to do?
Well, the student loan forgiveness. I mean, I think that's something that he could do right away. He has the ability to do it up to 50,000 is what Warren and Schumer called it. But even 10,000 would be good. I mean, let's just get some student loan relief. And that was part of the platform. On a positive side, I think the bill, which has $300 of child allowance for every American with kids, working class and middle class families, Columbia did a study that would cut child poverty by 50%. And you know, Matt Brewing has been pushing this idea. It's such a transformative idea, and if we can get that through, it would really make a difference.
And the $2,000 that were promised.
I wanted $2,000. That's what I would do. But my bigger concern is if it's going to be $1,400, let's not means tested and exclude the middle class. And so, progressives want $2,000. If it is $1,400, I think the bigger fight is don't write off the entire middle class and many in the working class.
Excellent. Congressman, thank you so much for coming on. We know you're busy. Really, thank you for taking time out of your schedule.
I enjoy it. Thanks for having me on and look forward to being back.
All right.
Yes, definitely.
Thanks so much. Absolutely. All
right. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was kind of a shit-stirring segment by you, right? You were just trying.
What do you mean? Just now?
Yeah, you were trying to pick a...
Yeah, but why not? Why isn't that... You know what? I'm like, I hold back. If there's anyone who can do it, it's Rokana. He doesn't get flustered by that stuff. He is diplomatic without being sycophantic. Yeah. And
Congressman, do you have a bag of shit that you'd like to throw at the president right now on the air?
Yeah. Look, I just gave him a great.
No, that was good. That was great video. Yeah. I like it. Yeah.
I think that you are too polite. Don't you want to ask questions like that? But your politeness, your Catholicism, gets in the way.
Definitely. All right. Thank you for listening to Useful Idiots.
Yes.
Rate and review us. Don't
subscribe.
Listen to anybody who we might reasonably be described as a competitor to this show.
Yeah. And in fact, when we talked about Jon Favreau, very important to mention he's not Jon Favreau from God Save America. Like the show, subscribe on YouTube, like and subscribe. And to do that, you just hit subscribe and then the bell. And then on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, make sure you subscribe. Write us a review. Give us some stars.
Or pointers.
Negative.
Yep. Okay. Thanks very much. And we'll see you next week.
And thank you to Sheer Mag for the theme song and to our producer, Daniel Halperin.